This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, mountain climber and writer Joe Simpson, faced death several times on one harrowing journey in the Peruvian Andes in 1985. His 1988 book, Touching the Void, has now been made into a movie, which combines interviews with Simpson and his climbing partner, Simon Yates, with reenactments of climbing scenes done by actors. Here's the real Joe Simpson speaking in the film, describing the treacherous landscape.
It was this undying nightmare of flutings of the finest powder gorged out by snow falling down, meringues and mushrooms and cornices all over the place. We'd heard about these strange powder snow conditions you get in the Andes, and we'd never seen them before. I don't know the physics that explains why powder snow can stay on such steep slopes. In the Alps, it would just slide off if the slope was above 40 degrees. It is some of the most precarious, unnerving, and dangerous climbing I've ever done.
Touching the Void tells the story of Simpson and Yates' climb up the west face of the Sierra Grande, a 21,000-foot Andean peak never previously summited. They reached the summit in 2.5 days, but disaster struck during their descent.
When we were coming down, we came down the North Ridge, and we spent half an hour coming down, then we bivouacked high on the ridge. And the next day, we started to come down again, and I was trying to down-climb a vertical ice cliff that was about 30 feet high, and some ice broke away. And my axe ripped out, and I fell about 20 foot max, more likely 15 foot, but I landed, my right leg hit first, and the impact drove my lower leg straight through my knee joint. My tibia went through my knee joint and split off. I also broke my heel and my ankle, but I didn't really notice that at the time. We were at 20,000 feet. This was all our nightmare scenarios come true, because we knew there was no other people in that area in the Andes. There was no mountain rescue, there was no helicopter. And usually to get a man this badly injured off a mountain, you'd have a 10-man rescue team, and Simon was just there on his own. And to my amazement, I thought he was going to have to leave me, and I wouldn't have blamed him if he had done, but he attempted to lower me down the mountain and at great risk to his own life, and lowered me for 3,000 feet before second disaster struck.
Tell us about the moment when your eyes first met Simon's and you explained to him what happened, and you both immediately realized the seriousness of the situation.
Well, when I impacted, I didn't actually feel it. I heard this sound like a sick, dry stick snapping, but then I just catapulted backwards and I started falling down the east face, and I thought Simon was going to get pulled with me, but after about 50 feet I stopped, and the pain was absolutely excruciating, and for a moment I couldn't believe I had broken my leg, because I remember seeing a mountain in the distance that we were level with the summit of, and I knew that we were still at 20,000 feet, and the implications of a fracture were like a death sentence. And I remember actually putting my hand inside my trousers to feel if there was a bone end sticking out, and there wasn't, so I thought that maybe I was just being a bit wet, so I tried to stand on it, and all the bones went again. I knew it was broken, and then suddenly the rope went snack, and it meant that Simon was coming towards me. And I was pretty much panicking at that point, because I thought, well, he's going to have to leave me, and he suddenly appeared at the top of the cliff, and he was looking at me and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, I've broken my leg." And he just looked at me longer, you know, longer than he should have done, really. He didn't say anything at all. And the sort of look he gave me was a sort of, it was strange, really. It was like looking at a wounded animal or something. And then he turned away because he had to try and sort out how he was going to get down this cliff to me. And I was very scared about that because he was silent. And I sort of realized now that, you know, we don't have, we're never taught any protocol, you know, by which you tell your friend that you're going to leave him to die, and he didn't know what to do, so he resorted to silence. In the meantime, I tried to climb sideways across this ice slope. There's about a 3,000-foot drop underneath me, and I was sort of thinking, well, it might, you know, show willing to Simon that I wasn't dead in the water, but I also thought, well, he's got to leave me, so I might as well try and get on with it. About an hour later, or 45 minutes later, he suddenly appeared by my side. And he didn't actually say anything. And I thought, well, this is the point that he has to leave me. and I couldn't really make eye contact with him. I knew what the score was, and he climbed below me and then up the other side. And after a while, expecting to see him gone, I looked to my right, and he was digging a small sort of foot trench in the ice and the snow, helping me to climb sideways towards him. And from that point on, I realised that, for reasons best known to himself, he was going to try and stay with me and help me.
So he improvises this fairly heroic attempt to get you down the mountain, at which you tie two 150-foot lengths of rope together, and you dig out a snow seat for him to brace himself, and he lowers you down 300 feet at a time.
Well, Simon lowered me from sort of 11 o'clock in the morning until like 9 o'clock at night in just the most phenomenal single-handed rescue that I've ever heard about. And suffering frostbite. We were both suffering frostbite in our fingers and our hands. And we were in the dark, in a storm, almost nil communication, no visibility after about 30 feet. And unbeknownst to us, he was lowering me towards an overhanging cliff of ice that was directly in our path, and he lowered me off the edge of it. And the sudden, complete body weight coming onto the rope very nearly pulled him off, and he had to let the rope go and then slowly, dynamically break the rope, by which time I was hanging out in space. I couldn't even contact the wall of the ice cliff, and to my horror, discovered that I was a long, long way above the base of this cliff, at which lay a covered up, but quite obviously a crevasse. Simon, desperate to get my weight off the rope, lowered me, hoping that, you know, after a few feet I'd put my feet on the ground. But after a while, when I was still hanging 80 feet above the crevasse, I came to a stop, and I knew that the knot joining the two ropes had come up and jammed in his lowering device, and we were locked into the system, and there was nothing he could do about it. And from then on, basically my body weight was pulling him off. He hung on to me for about an hour and a half. I could feel him sort of gradually inching down the mountain, and I was sort of jerking down. It was like being on a fishing line, and I just knew that he eventually would just get ripped off the mountain.
And you expected to die at that point?
Yes, I was in shock. I was in great pain. I was probably close to hypothermic, and I'd had about enough, really. I felt basically a sort of a twinge of anger that my friend was going to have to die as well, and it all, because we'd made a pretty strong attempt to save ourselves, and it seemed so unfair that it should all go wrong. Literally, probably one lower from the bottom of the mountain, and then suddenly I found myself free-falling backwards. Fell 80 feet, hit the roof of this crevasse, which is very thick. It almost stopped me. And then I broke through on my right shoulder and fell headfirst into this crevasse, into the darkness. Fell about another 75, 80 feet, and then powered into a snow bridge that was crossing the width of the crevasse and stopped.
Simon, you were fell because Simon had cut the rope.
I didn't know that. I thought Simon had fallen off. I had no idea. I thought he'd just come off, and that's what I was expecting, that he would suddenly, you know, come wanging off. And in fact, when I came to in the crevasse and made myself safe, and I looked at this rope that was going up and out through the ceiling of the crevasse, 80 feet above me, I thought, well, that's going to... Simon's body's flown over the crevasse and is dead down the slope, and if I pull on the rope, it will come tight in his body, and I can use that as a counterweight, and using special knots, I can climb up the rope. And so I kept pulling on the rope, and then... suddenly, there was this sort of, and this frayed rope came down, and it meant two things. It meant that Simon was alive, and he had my knife.
At that moment, were you angry that he'd cut the rope? Did you understand?
No, not at all. I was never angry. I mean, my friend was alive. You know, it was important. But more important, from an entirely selfish point of view, was that... you know, while he was alive, he could help me. I was now trapped in a deep crevasse that it was impossible to climb out of vertically from where I was. And, you know, Simon being dead was of absolutely no use to me and not much use to himself. And I then had a nightmarish night, not sure whether Simon was climbing down. Actually, he'd taken shelter quite wisely. I was then forced to make perhaps the most frightening decision I've ever made in my life, which was... You know, you don't die of a broken leg. You die slowly of dehydration and hypothermia, and it would take 3 or 4 days in a twilight world. I mean, crevasses are very claustrophobic, nightmarish places to be, and they have the feel of the tomb about them. And I wasn't prepared to do that, but my only option was to lower myself with my half of the rope deeper into the crevasse, which was completely counterintuitive to everything that my mind wanted to do. It was a very, very frightening decision, but I did eventually do it, and I lowered myself another 80 feet deeper into this crevasse, and to my great good fortune found a way by crawling towards the north. I found a slope running up about 160 feet and managed to eventually climb out of the crevasse.
So you did you're climbing out with your right leg utterly useless, using, I guess, what, ice axes, and pulling yourself up and crawling. And
yeah, it's quite a steep slope. I mean, you're having to hop upwards, and the trouble is if you fracture your knee, you can't bend your knee to get your lower leg out of the way. So when you hop out, you almost inevitably land on your bad foot, which puts pressure on the broken joint because your knee doesn't bend anymore. You know, the leg has gone through the knee joint, and so it was excruciatingly painful trying to climb up. And when I did get out, I mean, initially I was just laughing because I was so relieved to get out of this place, this sort of claustrophobic, nightmarish place where I was going to die. And then I looked around, and way off to my left I saw a rope hanging down, a rock and ice buttress, which Simon had obviously used to abseil down. And when I looked to the glacier, I saw his tracks in the snow, and I knew at that point that, you know, he would never have left if he thought I was alive, and that the only person who could possibly help me in this world that I was in now thought I was dead. And that was a pretty chilling moment.
But you took, what, 3 days, and...
Well, from then, another 3.5, best part of 4 days, really, without food and water. I eventually, on the morning of the fifth day since breaking my leg, and virtually 4 days since parting company with Simon, I got to within 200 yards of where the tents were, in the dark, in a storm, completely disorientated. And by then, very delirious and not really knowing where I was. I mean, by then I weighed about somewhere between 80 and 85 pounds, and I was probably dying at that point, and I was delirious. And I think I screamed out, not because I thought they were there, but just in desperation and fear. And suddenly these lights came on in a tent about 200 yards away, and they were still there. They were leaving 3 hours later at 6 in the morning, and suddenly Simon came sort of charging out of this tent and found me.
I want to just go back to one moment. When you had to make this overland trek, the 8 miles back down to the base camp, you had a bum leg.
One way of putting it.
Yeah, a shattered leg. You crawl, you hop. How did it work?
Well, you can't really crawl because you're crawling over boulders and huge sort of rocks, and often they're all jumbled on top of each other, so you're doing everything from hopping, using your ice axe as a walking stick, and trying to clamber over things, and you're falling virtually every time you try and hop. You're constantly falling, and you're falling on the broken knee, and I can't remember the pain, but I know it was just almost unendurable. I mean, I don't even remember the fear either, because that's difficult to recall, but I recall a long, drawn-out sense of abandonment, a loneliness that it's very difficult to put your finger on. I think what I now realize it was is dying. I was dying alone, and that's the memory I'm left with. And the one thing I think I kept doing was I was crawling not because I wanted to live, but because I wanted somebody to hold me when I died. And I still can recall that moment when Simon's hands grabbed my shoulders and he pulled me towards him and carried me to the tent. I mean, it was just the most extraordinary reprieve from, you know, it was as if I was walking to the gallows and somebody had just tapped me on the shoulder and said, "It's okay, Joe, everything's okay now, you're going to be safe."
Well, Joe Simpson, you write in this book that you were a different kind of climber back in, I guess you were 25 when you first made this disastrous attempt. Well, it was a successful climb, but a disastrous trip. You wrote of having a sense of invincibility, the confidence born of youth, too much testosterone, and too little imagination. Were you and Simon ill?
Right?
Yeah. Were you and Simon ill prepared for this thing?
No, not at all, no. I mean, there's no way we would have managed to climb that route if we were bad climbers. We made mistakes. Every friend of mine who's died in the mountains, and there's some 15 or 20 of them, made a mistake, and that's what killed them. The best climbers in the world that are dead made a mistake. That's just the game you're playing.
Well, were these mistakes of immaturity? I mean, looking back now,
no,
would you
not
do
really.
It differently?
I mean, I think that, you know, we'd done a huge amount of climbing, of extreme climbing in the European Alps in both the winter and the summer. We'd done some of the hardest routes in the Alps. We were technically very, very competent climbers. This was our first trip to high altitude, and so we were moving into a new plane and a new area. I would still have climbed the route in the same style. We did it in 2.5 days, and when the route was repeated, you know, 16 years later, the people who repeated it took the same time as us, despite the advance of 16 years of development of ice climbing gear. So we were good climbers. We would never have got up the face if we weren't good climbers. And to be truthful, we would never have survived what we did if we didn't know what we were doing. But without a doubt, we made mistakes. We didn't take enough food with us. We didn't take enough gas with us because we were trying to go as light and as fast as possible. And it meant that when something did go wrong, we didn't have any sort of backup in so much as we couldn't take shelter and take back control because we'd run out of gas and we couldn't make any water and we'd run out of food. And I suppose, just like any experience, and that this is what you do as climbers, you know, we got home, we looked at what we did wrong and thought, well, what did we do wrong? And then we went climbing again, having learnt very strong lessons. And that's tends to be what you do in climbing.
You know, one of the striking things about the ordeal you went through is that there were so many times in which it seemed clear that you were a goner. I mean, not many people come so near death. Did it change you at all? Did it change the way you look at climbing? Did it change the way you look at your life?
I never quite climbed the same again. I actually climbed at much higher technical standards on rock and ice, but, you know, a lot of high-end climbing is actually mental, and I never quite did such a committing route again, which I think was a shame. That was something stolen from me, but I didn't.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that? You said you never did such a committing route again. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I went to the Himalayas and Peru, and I did alpine-style first ascents of new routes, but they were never as technically difficult and serious as the one we did on Sous Le Grand, which is really what I wanted to do, you know. So that was not because of the technical difficulty. That was because of the mental scars that I carry with me from that experience in Peru. But, I mean, I don't regret that. I have climbed all over the world. But I think, you know, people sort of wonder what it must be like to experience something like this, and you don't feel when you survive something like this like, you know, you're sort of gung-ho or heroic or you've done anything, you know, particularly special, because the process of surviving this, or in my case, a long drawn-out dying, was very, very destructive, both physically and mentally, and perhaps mentally worst of all. You know, I never expected to be so slowly destroyed, so that everything that you thought you were, everything that you thought made you strong as a man or good as a person, was just whittled away until you were just a crying, feeble, childlike figure, and you'd even seem to have lost your whole personality. And right at the end, I was given my life back because Simon found me, and I just always felt, and have always felt, very humbled by the experience, that it was... It made me feel very fragile and very weak, even though I may have at times shown a great deal of strength and determination. It's never struck me as like that. It struck me that I was very lucky, and I just sort of live every day now and plan on things I want to do in the future. This did happen 18 years ago. Although the book's been very successful and now the film, it sort of locks you in the past and makes you always sort of seem to be living 1985 and touching the void all over again. But I don't do that. I think of the next book I want to write, the things I want to do with my gardening, the fly fishing trip I've got in Scotland next week. Not in Scotland, in Ireland. And I don't think about what happened in Peru. It's not worth dwelling on the past and beating yourself up. Just get on with life.
Well, Joe Simpson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Author and mountain climber Joe Simpson. His book, Touching the Void, is now a feature film.